issue is because we're talking about law. Who gets to be God? Who gets to be God's deputies? Who is the Most High? Who is the divine authority? It's all about the claim to the Most High. The only way that somebody can be higher than us is if we give away our power. Because there's nobody. We're all equal. But we're not equal in our knowledge. So ultimately, I think it does have to be a hierarchy, but it has to be a cooperative hierarchy, like a bee colony. It's about what our value system is, what we care about.
Hello, Universal Hive Mind. Today is May 20th, 2024. I'm your host, Nate Kapp, and welcome to the 69th Cubbyhole Podcast, where critical topics are unveiled, discussed, and tested. The website for today's show is cubbyhole.com. That's CubbyHole.com. And if you prefer to listen to the show on a different platform, you can also listen with Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon, TuneIn Radio, Pandora, Simplecast, YouTube, Odyssey, Minds, BitChute, and much more. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome to the Cubbyhole. I definitely recommend anybody who comes in and this is their first time to go back to show number one. Start there, work your way forward in order, so that way you'll have a better understanding of what this whole podcast is really revealing as a big picture understanding. Okay? And as for all studiers of this show, welcome back. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. I really appreciate people who take this work serious and go through the information in order. And I hope it's served you well. And if it has served you well, I hope it continues to do so. Now, there are going to be slides for today's show. So please go to cubbyhole.com, go to podcast 51 plus, which will be 51-100 eventually. And you're going to click on that, go all the way down to show 69, and there you will find the slides for today's show. Okay, and there's going to be a lot of slides, so please make sure that you're following along, so that way you'll have a better understanding of what it is that I'm conveying. Okay, so I hope you guys are all doing well. Hope you're excited. Hope you're ready to take in a lot of knowledge. Very, very in-depth knowledge. I've been looking forward to diving deeper into this eschatology, which is what we're going to further explore today. And I'm going to cover religious eschatology, historical eschatology, psychological eschatology. And if there's time, I will definitely get into ancient Egyptian eschatology, which is what I've been covering anyway for the past three or four shows, and really try to help us understand this phenomenon with a lot more clarity, because it's a very big, big subject. And it's very important to understand also that within the order of the Cubbyhole podcast, I'm currently and symbolically in the bottom half of the zodiac as far as what I've been covering regarding the ritual of Osiris, aka the solar and also the lunar cycles, with respect to the lower southern half of Earth below the equator and below the autumn equinox in particular. And this ritual of Osiris, this is what helps the seeker of truth understand not only the death of material light and the raising of spiritual light, you know, so going through the underworld and finding the care to raise that spirit back into the material body, but also this whole tracing board is all about agriculture, which is dealing with the planting season and the harvest season. Okay. It's also about fertility and so much more. But it's a correspondence. More than anything, it's a correspondence to human consciousness, to the soul. Okay? So we're going to really go deeply into the science of eschatology. But before we get into that, there are a few things that I need to cover. And the first thing that I'd like to mention is something that I revealed on the last show, which is my Earth Brain 3 presentation, which I'll be giving this November 2024. I still don't have a subtitle and I still don't have a date. So hopefully on the next episode or two, I will definitely make sure to have something for you guys to know exactly when it is and what the subtitle is. But it's a follow-up presentation to Earth Brain 1 and 2. And it's probably, I mean, it is going to be my biggest presentation that I've ever given, and probably the most important presentation to that date. So that being said, there is one other thing I'd like to get into, or a couple other things I'd like to get into before we get into the topics that I covered on the last show, which is very, very important. But Douglas Martin's presentation, Origins of Secret Societies Part 2. If you haven't got a chance to watch and study that presentation, definitely make sure to give yourself some time, get your notepad ready, and take a lot of notes. Watch that thoroughly because it goes hand in hand with where we're at in the Cubbyhole podcast. Okay. It's a very well done presentation, and it's dealing with eschatology, it's dealing with materialism, it's dealing with socialism, and it's just a very well done presentation that can really help anybody understand this science a lot further, because he really gets into also showing how this eschatology is within movies. And I think that, this whole ritual of Osiris, especially, because to understand that at a deeper level, to see it in movies, that can really help us understand this science a lot more. And it's going on in a lot of movies, let me tell you. But definitely do yourself a favor, check that out. I'll leave a link in the description. And also another link that I will leave up, if you'd like to check it out, is Logan Hart, who was actually on the Cubbyhole in show 66. He actually invited me to come on the Wizard Factory about a week later. So this was about 3 months ago. And we did a whole show of, the title of his show is The Myth of Osiris, with the subtitle, The Ancient Art and Science of Spiritual Awakening. And I'll leave a link in the description if you'd like to check that out. But it was a very, very big show. It was a little over 3 hours, and it was just really awesome. Such a great conversation, and Logan did such a great job, and I'm really thankful that he gave me the opportunity to get on there and really share this information, or really open it up. I mean, and when I say open it up, that's really an overstatement, because I barely scratched the surface in comparison to what I've been developing here on the Cubbyhole. But, you know, obviously 3 hours, it's hard to condense so much knowledge into such a small amount of time. But we really covered a lot, and it was a great show. So I definitely recommend checking that out. And also, if you haven't got a chance to check out Wizard Factory, the Wizard Factory podcast, I definitely recommend checking that out. And, you know, Logan has so much knowledge, so much great information, and he has a lot of great interviews that he's done. So make sure to go check out his work. And One thing I wanted to say, too, on that show is I made the mistake on that show that I wanted to correct here on this podcast, and hopefully I can correct it on his podcast eventually because it is a big deal. But I said that Osiris was the first deity in the solar mythos, and I definitely was wrong about that. So I want to be very clear. He was actually the last in line to be a solar deity because he was at his peak in around 20,000 BC. And when I say he, I'm talking as this solar deity of that time who was venerated, okay? And I would say as a nature god or nature power, okay? Not something that I believe there was an actual physical person, a human being or human-like person called Osiris. I don't believe that at all. I can't believe people actually do believe that. But the point is about understanding that the reign of Osiris being this elemental power that was venerated in the solar mythos was around 20,000 BC, okay, when Osiris was at his peak, okay? But the science of Osiris goes all the way back to the stellar being associated with the number 5 and the X. And that's, you know, I had a little bit of a dyslexic moment and I knew, you know, I had to listen to the show and I realized, oh, I definitely messed up on that. I did not mean to say that he was first in line. Ptah was actually the first. But the reason why I probably said that on his show was, you know, I'm thinking Osiris goes all the way back to the stellar. So that really kind of, you know, it caused a little bit of confusion in my mind at that moment. You know, this stuff is very difficult to orient yourself with. You have to be very careful with the history. So I'm correcting it. I was wrong. And it was just a minor, major mistake because we really have to understand that one of the biggest issues when it comes to Osiris is that most people, most Egyptologists, most so-called scholars believe Osiris was the first in line when really he was the last. So Ptah, though, Ptah, P-T-A-H, Ptah, was the first in line, as far as I understand, in the solar mythos. So just to be clear about these solar gods in order between the first, which is Ptah, to Osiris in the solar cult. So we have, again, Ptah is the first, then Atum, then Shu and Tefnut, then Nut or Nut, and Seb or Ra, which, you know, Nut and Seb conceive Osiris. Okay, so there's so much more to this, okay? But as we go through these shows, we will continue to cover this and flesh this out more. But I just wanted to point that out because, you know, this information is so fragile because it's already fragmented so much, and it would be a disservice to make such a major mistake and not correct it, you know. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody is on the same page, and I do realize that this is a very, very big, important part of understanding that if we don't understand the history and the timeline, then we really start to become scattered, more fragmented, you see. So we really have to stay true to the timeline the best we can. It's very difficult because, you know, how do we truly know? But we can know to some degree, okay? We can actually know. We can do the measurements. We can pay attention to the weaponry. We can pay attention to the symbols and the designs of temples. And we can pay attention to, you know, the weathering of stone and, you know, just really try to stay true to what it is that we're learning all through history. And if we can build a really good timeline, a very strong, robust timeline, you know, then we got to put that out there and try to help each other maintain a strong bridge back into antiquity. Because, yes, a lot of this information is timeless. It is universal, and it doesn't require history for it to be what it is. But, and that's very important because that's how we discover this information in the first place. But then we have to have time to develop these sciences and these ideas. You see, and when we're developing these ideas and sciences, it's because we're discovering them in nature and we're discovering how they work in nature. And so there's so much to it, but now I don't want to spend too much time on catching us up on the last episode number 68, but there are a few things that are just very important to really put a finer point on. So the first thing that I talked about on the last episode was primal fears, which consist mostly of darkness, predators, abandonment, and chaos. And these all have to do mostly with the sun. Because darkness is a primal fear because what? We don't have light. We don't have warmth. We don't have nutrients. So it becomes a fear. So to live in the darkness as a primal fear is because of the absence of light being the sun, okay? And then we also have predators, which coming out at night are a lot more scary. You know, this creates more of a fear. And one of the things that I talked about in that episode was the human predators who reside, who operate from the shadows, which is the darkness. So these are the predators that create this primal fear because, you know, predators are those who are violent or those who will actually cause harm, whether that be humans or animals, right? So we have this deeply embedded within us, and it has a lot to do with predators that come out at night. We're more afraid of predators at night than we are in the day. Okay, so it has something to do with the sun. And also, there's abandonment, which is the abandonment of the light going either down at the end of the day or the light going, you know, if you're in the northern hemisphere, when the sun is going below the autumn equinox down to the winter solstice, the sun is going away, the days are getting shorter and darker and colder, and there's less nutrients. So this causes an abandonment deep down within that if we're not conscious of that, we'll not understand the bigger picture of how we can be manipulated by, you know, not being aware of this very simple trauma. And also I got into chaos. And that definitely has a lot to do. It's very layered. Chaos is very layered when it comes to the primal fear and dealing with the sun, because chaos has a lot to do with darkness. Being in darkness mentally and spiritually is what causes chaos. And but there's so much to that. But if you'd like to know more, if this is your first time listening to this show or this podcast and you haven't heard the other show prior to this one, I definitely recommend going back and listening to that so you really have a better understanding of what these primal fears, because to understand primal fears in correspondence with the zodiac, that's where we're really going to understand the depths of this science of eschatology. Okay, so this is all dealing with this. Well, what I was talking about in that show is the solar mythos mostly. Okay, obviously, when you're talking about the zodiac, you're talking about mostly the solar mythos, but you're also talking about the lunar and the stellar, because the solar mythos does have remnants of the lunar and stellar. And I know I've said that many times, but I just have to always repeat that so we understand that it's not like they're completely separate, okay? So, but it's very sophisticated in a certain way. So we have to be oriented and we have to stay clear in the way that we differentiate the three, okay? So this zodiac that I've been talking about, this is a tracing board. It's what we use to trace ourselves out, our souls. It's what we use to really see the bigger picture of reality. And we can learn this. This is esoteric Freemasonry, because esoteric Freemasonry is all about tracing on the trestle, which means to trace out the soul through symbols and through allegory, okay? Because it is a system of morality. And the more that we understand this, the more we can appreciate this zodiacal wheel a lot further. And the other thing that I talked about was the autumn equinox all the way down to the winter solstice. This bottom right corner of the zodiac is such an important study in and of itself, because this is what deals with darkness. This is what deals with chaos. This is what deals with control and ego. There's so much that goes into it, okay? And also from the autumn equinox all the way down through the winter solstice to the spring equinox, this is known as symbolically Amenta. And Amenta means the middle of the earth, okay? So this is dealing with, this whole bottom half of the zodiac is dealing with the soil, it's dealing with earth, it's dealing with water. So Amenta is not an actual place. Amenta is, it's a sacred land. That's what it means, okay? Just like Middle Earth, there, it's not an actual place. It just means a sacred land, meaning, you know, the most internal, sacred, central place in the self, okay? And Amenta is where we go through the underworld. It is the underworld that we must go through. However you want to define that, you know, we can even call it hell. Something else that I got into on that show, because going through hell is about hell actually translates to the underworld or to save. Okay, because that's what we're doing when we're going through the underworld symbolically. We're going through there to save ourselves, to find ourselves, to burn the material away, to burn all the bad parts away, because it has a lot to do with morality. It has a lot to do with finding the difference between right and wrong, because the reason that we are living in hell is because most of the people of this world, including my younger self, believed in moral relativism, which is believing that there is no actual objective difference between right and wrong. That's what creates hell on earth. Okay, so I want to be very clear on something that I didn't really stress enough when I talked about hell on the last episode, which is we have to understand hell as, you know, when, you know, hell being raised on earth versus raising hell in a rebellious way. So hell on earth, symbolically, if you look at the zodiac, the upper half would be akin to fire or analogous to fire, right? Even the sign is fire, okay, in this part of the zodiac, especially, you know, from the summer solstice down to the autumn equinox, this is the fire sign, okay? So this is about being in materialism, which is when people dwell in materialism, then what this creates, especially a world where people believe in moral relativism, which generates a world of materialism and literalism, this creates hell on earth. Okay, so this whole top half of the zodiac would be the fire, and then the bottom half would be earth. Okay, so this is hell. This is the hell world. Okay, that's one way we can look at it. But going through the underworld, aka hell, to go through all the pain and suffering of going through the awakening process, to awaken that spirit, to raise that spirit up into the material, that is the second birth. But this, you can also look at this as this is about raising hell on earth morally, because the true rebellion in this world is a moral rebellion. And that means to raise hell against socialism, because socialism is immoral. So to raise hell on earth is about raising that spirit of fire up into the material world, okay? And that doesn't mean go burn cars and break windows and burn cities down. What that means is, for instance, what I'm doing right now is I'm raising hell. I am a true rebel in this world, because I'm rebelling against the immoral, corrupt system, okay? The inverted system of nature. I'm rebelling against that because I understand the objective difference between right and wrong. Therefore, I am raising hell as a rebel, okay? But I'm raising hell with principles of natural law. So that means that if you're raising hell on earth and flipping cars and burning things, that's not really ever going to solve anything, okay? That's what people think of when they think of anarchy. That's how people see or portray anarchy. That's how their mind has taken to that idea or to that word. That's what they associate it with, okay? So you cannot be a true rebellious anarchist without raising the spirit of principles of natural law. It's impossible. You'll just go in circles in materialism. Most anarchists, I would say, they understand that something is wrong, but they're still stuck in that material mindset. And they'd argue all day long that they're not, but they don't understand that you must go through the process of finding out the objective reality, being the difference between right and wrong. Because when you find that out, then you start to come in contact with the world of the occult. And when you realize how important that is, then you realize what true rebellion is. Okay? Truly. And I definitely recommend anybody who has not listened to Brandon Martin's newest or one of his newest presentations, The Spirit of Freedom. You definitely need to check that out. I think that's what the name is, The Spirit of Freedom. It's a very, very well done presentation, and it really hits on this very well. And so definitely make sure to check that out. The other things that I talked about, you know, dealing with this underworld is this is the tomb. This is the womb. This is dealing with death. This is dealing with, of course, this is all darkness. It's the soil, the black soil of Kemet or Egypt. Okay. And this is all dealing with the cult of Osiris. This is dealing with the inner journey of the soul. Okay. This is dealing with the spirit. This is dealing with the mind. This is dealing with the body, the brain. It's all eschatology, dealing with final things. This is the metamorphosis from the material, descending down into the underworld to find that spirit, to raise that spirit into the, you know, if you thought of a caterpillar metamorphosizing into a butterfly, the butterfly would be the spirit raised and unified with the material, the feminine unified with the masculine into the material body, which would be the butterfly. And this is the reason that I made that whole image for the Seed 5 Metamorphosis Conference. So this is also dealing with the number 14, because we're dealing with the pieces of Osiris being cut up by his brother Typhon or Set, who chops him up and spreads all his pieces of his brother all scattered throughout the whole world. And this is all about taking light or truth and completely shredding it, compartmentalizing it, and spreading it throughout the whole world so no one can find the pieces and put it back together. And if they do, it'll take their whole life to do so. And, you know, we have to understand that, and this is what keeps Set or Typhon as the ruler from darkness, okay? And this is what also maintains control over the material mind, and I'm going to get into that. But one thing I want to be very clear on is there is a positive reason for this part of the myth or this part of the eschatology, which is that 14 pieces being chopped up is the way, remember, to in order to understand a circle, we have to understand it in parts, you see? Because even though it's pure as a circle, how could you even begin to understand or appreciate something so holy without understanding all the parts? That's what understanding even means, is to understand all the parts all put together. You see, so the positive aspect of all 14 pieces is that we get to go and search for the 14 pieces of symbolically the truth, which is Osiris. Okay, so all 14 pieces are symbolically the pieces that we get to find our care through. To find our care, that's why Isis is associated with care, because she goes in search for the pieces of her husband, Osiris, to put him back together. So all those 14 pieces represent the pieces of truth. And of course, that 14th piece that she does not find you know, we have to remember that that's also akin to the fact that we're never going to get the ultimate truth. So very, very important point that I wanted to make there. And also, I got into Isis and Nephthys, her twin sister. And her twin sister, Nephthys, conceives Anubis with Osiris. And this is what where we get this understanding of deception, because Typhon deceives Osiris at the same time that Osiris is deceived by Nephthys. And so Typhon and Nephthys are brother and sister, and they are also married, okay? They are wedded. So we have to understand the wedding of the dark side, okay? And but they both do this deception of the sun, or of the light of Osiris. They both deceive Osiris, and that's very important to this bottom right quarter of the zodiac, okay, dealing with Anubis, because Anubis is dogma. Anubis is the jackal, the dog-headed god, who is the guardian of the beings who are on their way to possibly the afterlife. So he is the one who escorts those who are on their way to have their heart weighed against the feather, okay? So Anubis is a very important part of this whole mystery, because Anubis is associated with the black cube, and Anubis is also associated with dogma, because it's all about finding where the dogma is in order to find the truth. And so we have to go all the way into the deepest, darkest place, which that's why Anubis is associated with decay and the black soil, because we have to go all the way down to find that seed of truth. We have to dig very deeply, okay? And that's also, you can correspond a dog digging for something in the dirt in order to find what it is that he is sensing. Okay, so there's some very beautiful correspondences and sciences to all these amazing archetypes and elemental powers, these nature gods. Okay, now the thing that I really want to make very clear about what I talked about in the last episode is this idea of free will in the land of the living, as according to when you think of Osiris as the god of the living, Osiris is the R complex, the most beautiful gift of a human life is the R complex, because the R complex is what pushes us to survive every single day of our life and have the experience that we get to have in this beautiful wild life that we all get to, you know, again, experience. So when it comes to the world in the upper half of the zodiac prior to the sun falling into the autumn, below the autumn equinox, this is the place of materialism, which is a simulation in nature. There is a simulation in nature, meaning it's organic, because when the R complex is the ruler of the brain, that means that everyone is living in fear in some way or another, which means being ignorant to what truly is going on in this world, but also you're living. Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with living that way, truly. However, the problem with it is that if we stay that way, okay, so this is it's all about understanding the conditioning of the human mind. When we stay in materialism, that's when we get into trouble. That's when everything becomes literalized. That's when we lose connection with nature and earth. That's when we, you know, have tons of massive wars with each other. Everything just becomes a mess, okay? It's pure chaos, as you can see, okay, if you're really paying attention to what's really going on in the world. So what I want to be so clear on, though, is that just because people who are in materialism or literalism, that does not mean, just because they're in a simulation, does not mean they escape natural law, okay? That does not mean that just because it's a simulation, it doesn't mean that free will does not exist for them, okay? It just means that they're not aware of free will. They don't understand the difference between right and wrong. They don't understand consciously. They're not conscious, or they don't have a conscience of the difference between right and wrong behavior. Therefore, they're living in a simulation of the R complex, living in fear. Okay. But see, whenever someone is in a simulation of the R complex, they can actually violate someone else and they will receive consequences from natural law, because we're all bound to natural law, whether we're conscious of it or not. That is how natural law is a mechanism that helps us as human beings learn our lessons in reality. If there wasn't this law, we would never feel bad for the actions that we do to others that harm them. We would never feel anything, actually. We would never feel the need to say sorry. We would never feel the need to, you know, do anything that would indicate that we have done something wrong. We would just never learn lessons in life, period. Okay, especially not moral lessons. Okay, but most people understand there is a moral lesson to be learned while we're here. That's what natural law is. Natural law is a fixed, inherent law within creation that we have the ability to become conscious of. And then through that, through conscience, we have the ability to choose right behavior over wrong behavior. But in a simulation of materialism, we're not conscious of that. And then we wonder, well, maybe most people don't really wonder why bad things happen to them through the law of karma, because the law of karma is, that is what natural law really is, okay? Because people, just because they don't understand or they're not conscious, they don't escape the consequences. So that being said, the dark psychologists of this world who understand the sciences that I'm talking about, who dwell in the dark, okay, the dark occultists, the high-level Satanists of this world, these people, they understand that people are living in this our complex simulated system of materialism. They understand that very well. And because of that, they understand that it is, this whole system is driven by fear. Okay. And because of this, they understand that they can install their agendas through fear into the minds of the masses. Okay. And this all has to do with the Hegelian dialectic, you know, problem, reaction, solution. And so this science, they understand it very well. And this is how they operate. They know that most people never stick their head down in the dark side and go all the way, because they know people are living in fear. And so this is how they sell the satanic mindset into the minds of the materialists. Whether they be Christian, whether they be Muslim, whether they be atheists, they're all residing in this material mindset. Most people don't realize this, but most religionists of this world are actually materialists, and I'm going to get into this. But the point is that the dark priest class of this world, they understand this information very well, and they understand that nobody escapes natural law. Nobody escapes the consequences of their behaviors, and therefore they will just continue to feed their agendas into those minds of materialists who have no idea of the dark side of their self, who don't understand the sacred feminine, who don't understand the occult, who don't understand the true spiritual, the journey of the soul. They don't understand that because they're too wrapped up in fear. Okay, so they're holding the flames high. The people in materialism are holding the world hostage in fire, you see? So that's why it is the great work to try to reach the materialists of this world, and also to try to reach the dark occult of this world as well, because they're going to keep on doing what they're doing regardless of what true light workers will do to try to inspire others. They want control because, well, for one, it's so easy. They can just, you know, kick back, put their feet up on the desk, and they don't even, all they got to do is flick their fingers, and they have people right where they want them. I mean, just look at what took place with the lockdowns, okay? That really demonstrated just how much power and influence that these people actually have on the minds of the masses, okay? So, very, very important point that I wanted to make there about free will, because nobody, just because free will is not ignited or not made conscious yet, does not mean that you do not have free will, and it does not mean that you that anybody magically escapes consequences for their behavior. Okay, so it's a very, very big topic, and of course the more that we learn about this information and really dive deeply into the symbolism and really understand the world of the occult and the methods of manipulation, aka mind control, which is something that Brandon and I covered pretty extensively in shows through 18 through 42. That is what these people are doing on a day-to-day basis to most minds of the world. So hopefully that, you know, makes sense. Hopefully it resonates. And I will be going further into that as we go through this information, because I really do think it's so important to really demonstrate how much and how easy minds are manipulated from those who dwell in the dark. And all these people who are living in materialism, their minds are in the dark. That's why they are ancillary Satanists. Okay, this is something that we have not really got into on this show. Okay, so I don't want people to be confused when they hear Satanism or how it's being used. But, you know, just to, you know, briefly cover what I mean when I say Satanism is those who are living in with the mindset of moral relativism, those who believe in the most ruthless gets to rule over everyone else, which is social Darwinism, or that, you know, living a selfish life where there's no care for the suffering of others, there's no acknowledgement for the suffering of others. It's just a me mentality. It is putting the self as the most high, you know, because it's about recognizing or believing as an ideology, because that's all it is that you are the only one that's really important in this world. And you just do everything for yourself and, you know, screw everybody else as long as you're happy, as long as you have everything you need. And, you know, this is also dealing with the R complex and ego. It's all egotism. And it is a very, very big topic. And again, we're going to go very deeply into this whole ideology as we go through these shows. Okay. Now, one thing that I'm going to keep on hammering, and I'm really glad that we got Logan Hart to come on and talk about this, but animism, this worldview of animism, understanding that there is spirit central in everything, okay? This is what's going to really help us understand natural law on a very deep spiritual level, okay? Because when we can understand that there is spirit in everything and realize everything truly is connected, then we can operate in this world more consciously, you see? And it really helps us break free of this materialism of the mind, okay? And again, when I say materialism, when I'm demonizing materialism, it's a mental aspect, okay? It's not material itself. And I really have to keep on saying this, because material itself, there's nothing inherently evil or wrong with material. It's when people have a mindset where their five senses are dominant, meaning that everything is material and that's it, okay? Even though, and you know, again, when I talk about religionists who are materialists and they don't even realize it, they say that they're spiritual. I'm telling you, when you understand that the belief in man as authority, that's materialism. If you believe in a solar messiah, that's materialism, because the sun is material, okay? But remember, I said that the sun is a proxy for spirit, okay? That's the feminine, okay? Spirit is feminine. Really, spirit is feminine and masculine when you really understand it on a very deep level. But the point is to understand that spirit is within everything, okay? Spirit is within everything. And these religionists really do not understand that, because they are too busy having faith and belief rather than doing the real research and becoming conscious of what material is versus spirit. because you have to study them separately to understand them as one. You see? Because there really is no separation. That's what it's about. That's what it's all about when you really look at it eclectically and give it time, give it attention, ruminate on the information. That's what the journey is about. It's not a, the journey is not about faith and belief. Faith and belief is never going to bring you to the truth. You see? So animism is a very important aspect, a very important worldview that I truly believe people need to invest more time into understanding, because it's very simple, yet it takes time to understand because we live in a world of materialism, and so we're trying to break free of that. Animism is what helps us break free of material being the dominator. It's what helps us break free of the R complex being the dominator of the whole brain, you see? And that's why natural law is so vital simultaneously, because natural law is the crux of the occult that unfolds all this information. It makes everything make sense. So, yeah, we also got into anarchy and you know, this is all dealing with astrotheology. And also, oh yeah, I got into the sabbatical year. And the sabbatical year, again, this is a very important part of this whole zodiac, because the sabbatical year is all about crop rotation for 6 years. And then the seventh year is to give the crops and the soil a rest. Okay. So just think about that in correspondence to the creation story with the seventh day of rest. Think about that with the seventh day of the week, because we live, especially in the Western world, we live in a highly, highly deep in the solar cult, in the sense that the seventh day of the week is Sunday. That is a Christian day of the week. And so this is, you know, this is the day typically of rest, because most people don't work as much on a Sunday compared to all the other days of the week. This also corresponds to the fact that a human body will recharge its cells every 7 years. It will get rid of a lot of the older cells and renew the cells. You see, so there's so much to that number seven. I mean, it goes on and on, but the more that we bring the knowledge to that one symbol of the seven, we can really start to see the bigger picture, okay? And there's so much beauty in it, but it's because people have literalized a lot of this stuff so much, especially with these messiahs and gods and elemental powers. When you literalize any of that, you are living in the material mindset, okay? And so there's so much. But, you know, this sabbatical year is also, you know, in correspondence with the zodiac. It's all about agriculture and fertility, like I said, about when to plant and when to harvest. And also, one thing that I find very interesting is this word for an animal called ox. Because think about this, Ra was the bull of heaven. So that's what an ox is. It's a bull. And Osiris was the bull of earth. So Osiris is connected with this X. So ox is OX. But when you overlay the X on the O, that is all about understanding Osiris. Osiris. This is about agriculture and fertility associated with Osiris, because Osiris is the bull of Earth. And this is all tied in with Taurus as well. So we're going to, you know, get into that as we go. And I know that Doug and Brandon have kind of mentioned that in the past, but, you know, this is very important science that we must understand, because we have to find out where the corruption is and also find out what the science is that's associated with it, so we know about these types of things, so we don't have to depend on someone else to do these things for us, aka government, which is socialism. Okay, so there is a lot to the rest of the show, and I just want to let everyone know that I'm going to do my best to get through all the slides. So please make sure that you are on the very first slide, and hopefully you guys were paying attention with the first slide, with what I was just saying, because I know it would be so much more helpful with, you know, having the image while I went through all that information. So I guess I should have just told everybody to go jump on the slide and follow along while I went through that information just now about the other show. I mean, I guess I did mention that, but either way, if you go back and listen to everything that I just said while looking at the Zodiac, it can be very helpful to understand what it is that I was explaining. Okay. So this Zodiac, the science of the Zodiac, this is dealing with the cycles of Osiris. This is also dealing with, mostly dealing with, the solar mythos. Okay. So I'm sharing this first slide because I just want to let everyone know the major area of the Zodiac that we're dealing with, just so we're honed in and just so we're oriented with the rest of the show. Okay. So we're following the path of the sun, dipping down into the southern hemisphere, falling into a tomb, autumn, below the autumn equinox, into the symbolic tomb, which is where this underworld journey symbolically begins. Okay. But as the sun approaches the winter solstice, this is symbolically where the sun goes to quote unquote die. Okay. Or you can look at it as this is where the seed is being planted. You can look at the sun as the seed from the masculine going down into the sacred feminine, or down into the dirt, the soil, being planted into the soil. Okay? This is all about the eschatology, which is about the death, symbolically the death of, or ritualistically the death of Osiris. So just keep this in mind, okay? Now, let's go a lot further with making sense of this eschatology, what it really is, okay? So we're going to go to the first slide. And this is the word eschatology. The word eschatology, the etymology of eschatology, comes from the Greek eschatos, which means last, furthest, uttermost. And then the suffix logi, which means study of. So it means the study of final things. Or you can also say the study of last things. Okay, so it's dealing with the science behind the idea of end times. So just keep in mind, you know, things like the end of a year, or the end of a day, or the end of a time period or the end of an age or the end of a life or the end of a cycle, okay? Eschatology deals with the immortality of the soul. And so immortality just means the continuation of the soul after death, which in this case is the migration of the soul and rebirth and rejuvenation and resurrection and the end of time. And basically any system of doctrines concerning last or final matters, such as death, judgment, the afterlife, and so on. So it's really also about understanding that by studying final things, it's also about studying the new beginning, because both help define each other. Okay, so this field of eschatology possesses an interdisciplinary essence, weaving together the threads of theology, which is the study of the nature of the Creator, and philosophy, meaning the study of truth and morality, which is about having the love of knowledge, and anthropology, which is dealing with the science of the human story, being culture and origins, their timeline. So, you know, weaving together these threads into a rich fabric of understanding. So, if you're looking at the slide in the top right, this is the judgment hall of Osiris with the weighing of the heart against the feather. Okay, this corresponds to the second degree of esoteric Freemasonry with that tracing board. Okay, the fellow craft tracing board. Okay, this is what this corresponds to. So below that is the esoteric Christian eschatology in one image, if you want to look at it that way, where you see all the fire at the bottom. You know, that would be hell, with all the monsters, with all the predators, everything scary down there, the place that no one ever wants to go, right? Everybody's afraid to go down there. But that is where we must go in order to learn how to raise that spirit. So that's why you see a cross in the middle with the eye, and raising up from that point all the way to the top. That's about raising that spirit up to the material. Okay? So even in esoteric Christianity, the imagery can help us understand this idea, okay? So now let's go to the next slide, which is eschatology. I guess all the slides are probably going to say eschatology, but the one where you see the blue zodiac wheel, and then you'll see Osiris at the bottom laying down as the corn god. So for over 100,000 years, the profound science of eschatology has been transmitted via symbols, archetypes, the zodiacal wheel, allegories, legends, and revered mythological figures such as Osiris and Horus. Its essence is enshrined in uranography, which is the mapping of the stars, as well as the celestial bodies of planets and the moon and the sun. However, its purity has since eroded amidst the interpretations found in various modern religious and historical texts. And this is all due to ignorance. It's all due to control. And like I keep on saying, it's about the literalization of these sciences, aka literalizing the elemental powers, literalizing the Messiah. So we're going to go to the next slide with a quote from Albert Churchward, who says, "There was no human figure personalized in the mythology of Egypt." That just that one part right there is so important to pay attention to, because it's followed up with, when the human figure appeared, it ceased to be mythological and became eschatological. So that means that in Egypt, just remember, Kemet, Egypt, it means, you know, there's Lower Egypt, there's Upper Egypt, and this all corresponds to Earth as well. Okay, so we have to just keep that in mind. But the point is that mythology was largely dealing with zootypes, which are animals. And then when us human beings wanted to try to understand ourselves better, we started to add animal parts to the human body, like putting a head of a bird on a human body, or a crocodile head on a human body, or putting wings on a human body, or putting a human head on a bird as a way to store this knowledge of, you know, the sciences of nature, but also it's because we're trying to understand ourselves better. But this is anthropomorphization. So to anthropomorphize is to add human attributes or human characteristics to nature, okay? Because it's a way for human beings to try to understand themselves or ourselves in nature, in connection to nature. And of course, there is corruption that can and has come with that, okay? And that's what we're trying to address, okay? But it's a very beautiful thing, because we're human beings, we're trying to understand, and we're trying to maintain these beautiful connections to nature. And we're doing this through archetypes. We do this through the mythology. We do this through the eschatology. And as we go through this science, we will really start to understand this, and hopefully more people will start to appreciate it. It is something that I have grown to really appreciate about the human story and our species, because it's beautiful. It's very rich. It's animistic, and it's a huge, huge, big deal. So we're going to go to the next slide. And, you know, Albert Churchward, just, you know, one of the greatest researchers on helping us understand the mythology going into the eschatology. I mean, it's something that I really hope more people that are listening take more serious and go into that study, because it really does help us understand our connection. It helps us understand the evolution of the mythos. And, you know, it's all about understanding ourselves. So let's go to the next slide, the next eschatology slide, where you see the little mountain on the left with the light at the top and then the feather on the right. So understanding history illuminates an enduring narrative of escalating crises, a foreboding journey toward a potentially perilous end, which is just a risky, dangerous end to something, okay? Whether spurred by the discord of good and evil or the ominous rise of danger demanding redemption, these crises underscore humanity's struggle, especially their spiritual struggle, True eschatology isn't about pessimistic denial or blindly believing in progress. Instead, it embodies hope. Okay, this is what I've been trying to say, or this is what I explained with the Master Mason tracing board with the Weeping Virgin Goddess and time. So the Weeping Virgin is standing over the grave or over the dugout of the Hiram Abiff's tomb or his casket, and she's holding a sprig of acacia, which represents hope. Okay, the hope for the rising light, the hope for the spirit to rise, the hope for freedom. So it embodies hope, which is a beacon of freedom amid oppression, or salvation amidst the tumultuous seas of chaos and ignorance. So basically, it's about recognizing the condition of human slavery and doing the necessary shadow work with the hopes to, egress out of that mire, out of that muck of ignorance, mostly without, going through too much suffering as a result. But that there's no guarantee there, trust me. And as I've stated in the last episode, it's about refusing to let ignorance dominate the self any longer, okay? We cannot let ignorance win this battle. That's what the symbolism of the checkerboard floor is all about. Not knowing the difference between light and dark, or good and evil, or good and bad, or right and wrong. Not having an understanding of that is why ignorance is dominant in most people's minds. That's why people are so confused. It's all confusion when you don't understand the difference between right and wrong, or dark and light. And, when we really look at the big picture of eschatology, we'll see that man's true passion for knowing and understanding final things, or the end, it's not just some made-up BS to build religious control structures or cults from. And yes, religion itself as a restraint on consciousness is the overarching problem in this world. But the idea of eschatology, it's a built-in mechanism at the core of our being. And this is what desires to understand and further connect to nature, to source. It's a way to recognize growth and adulthood, and recognize, entering mastery over the automated R complex and materialism, the lower self. This is what I was talking about earlier. It's a way that we can remember our being back to source, back to nature. And that's if we understand this science correctly and eclectically. That's what leads to freedom. That's what leads to our sovereignty, to be conscious, to see what we're going through, to become conscious of what we're actually going through, to become conscious of our human condition. Now let's go to the next slide. And this is a very powerful slide right here. Okay. Not that the slide is powerful, but the information is just very, very important when you're dealing with religion, the world of the occult, or esotericism. Syncretism is, if you think of it like symbolism, okay, one of the definitions that I give of symbolism is to compare one thing with another. That's one of the best ways to describe symbolism, because syncretism, well, the definition states the combining of different religions, cultures, or ideas. So when two or more distinct traditions come into contact, you know, when you're putting them side by side, they may merge in the likeness of the knowledge, resulting in a synthesis that incorporates elements of each original tradition. You see? So that's where we basically are going to see the similarities. So basically, it's about discovering the likeness in the information, what's similar about the teachings that leads us to more of a correct understanding of reality. So it's about the synchronization of information, which is, this is all about getting closer to truth, closer to light, something that, again, faith and belief can never achieve. You cannot faith or believe your way to truth. That's not how it works. Okay? That doesn't mean you can't have, you know, certain feelings and some, you know, deep, you know, deep-rooted connection with the Creator. It just means you're never going to get to the truth through faith or belief. Okay? Syncretism is how you're going to get to truth. And we will see this. This is all about pattern recognition. So as we go through the rest of this information, and I hope that anybody who's listening has really caught on to the fact that everything that I'm talking about, I'm always pattern recognizing or pattern connecting for the listener. I'm always trying to connect the dots for the listener in their mind. So syncretism, that's one of the ways, that is a correct definition for that type of method for finding the truth. Okay, so when I'm going through all these different types of eschatologies, I want you to pay attention with syncretism. I want you to pay attention, pattern recognize, to see what is so similar about the things that I'm talking about with each other. That's where you're going to synthesize the information into something pure, okay? Because it's all about getting back to the truth. So let's go to the next slide, which is eschatology psychology. So psychologically, eschatology delves into how individuals or societies perceive and navigate finality, be it end times or ultimate destinies. And unlike religious or mythical eschatology, this approach delves into the human psyche and emotions and cognitive processes concerning existential concerns and pondering ultimate realities. And this doesn't mean religious or mythical eschatology doesn't have anything to do with the mind, because they most certainly do, okay? This is all about the isolated mind that exists without these sciences or without these religions or cults. But psychological eschatology really can't be truly understood without mythical or historical or religious eschatologies, because it's all part of the human story and evolution. Okay. So just, we have to differentiate to really make sense of this idea and how deep it is. You know, we have to divide everything up like set. We have to divide all this information up in order to come to a better understanding of the whole picture, right? So a key aspect of psychological eschatology involves examining how individuals deal with mortality and the inevitable end of life. This entails exploring psychological defense mechanisms like denial or acceptance, and understanding how individuals construct personal narratives to find meaning in their existence amidst mortality. And on a broader scale, psychological eschatology offers insights into how the mind, the human mind, grapples with contemplating the end times, whether that be dealing with physical or spiritual, and its ramifications for mental well-being and societal dynamics. So this is a very deep subject, because we're all designed, we're all coded with this thought and feeling of the end of things or the beginning of things. We want to know what is the beginning and what is the end, so that way we can have a better understanding of the now. So it's a very, very powerful science. Now, I think it's really important to make a distinction between what's known as historical eschatology and mythical eschatology, okay? So let's go to the next slide, which is historical versus mythical, okay? And historical eschatology deals with chronological events in time that contain the structure of history and are necessary to understanding its progress. Okay, now think about the Bible. The Bible, and you know, really any biblically influenced eschatologies are considered historical, and they are directed towards the historical future. And so from this view, experiences are never truly universal. So that being said, think about there's this ritual which is called the Jewish Seder. Okay, and this is the ceremonial dinner during Passover, which is, it's not an attempt to repeat any events and experiences from the past, but it is a way to remember them through the telling of history and tradition. And, you know, Passover is a biblical story of the Israelites escaping slavery in Egypt. Okay, that's very important to understand. And, you know, also by rituals, I'm talking about events where a novum is symbolically expressed. And a novum just means a new thing or action that is symbolically expressed or experienced. Okay, so the idea is that hope will be grounded in historical remembrance, but will transcend what is remembered historically. So it's about using known history as a reminder, as an inspiration through ritual with this idea of hope in order to, you know, attain and maintain freedom. That's the idea, at least from the Jewish Passover perspective, okay? And we can't get this tradition confused with the mythical tradition either, okay? So we have to Just understand, this is just about creating a ritual that can help people not repeat the same mistake by helping them understand what happened in the past that was very horrific and bad, and that way there won't be another tragedy that happens as a result of maintaining this ritual in people's minds, okay? So there's a good reason for it, okay? But it's based in history. It's not based in mythical tradition, okay? It's not a mythical way of preserving. It's not a mythical ritual, okay? Now, mythical eschatology preserves archetypal motifs within folklore, legends, and ancient stories that deal with the process of creating order out of chaos, which occurs at the end of time and beginning of time. So pay attention to the beginning and the end of stories in history as mythical eschatology, okay? Pay attention to the cycles that they're associated with as well, okay? And it's important to understand that this is the art and importance of oral tradition as well. So in mythical eschatology, the origin of the world is reproduced at the end of the world, or the age, or the time period. Okay, so in the beginning, according to this approach, fixed natural laws and the pure order of things, they're discovered, they're recognized, they're aligned to, but eventually the corruption of man tries to mimic these natural laws, pretending to be the lawmaker, which inevitably leads to societal decay. It leads to destruction. It leads to devolution. It leads to socialism. And this science I'm talking about, it's actually preserved in the ritual of the murdering of Osiris by his brother, Typhon. This is why these myths are so valuable, because they help the individual realize that they have the power to overcome corruption internally and dewire the dominator R complex, the internal material socialist control system, that they have the ability to remove this from their mind. We all have this ability. And then rewire ourselves to nature and find, this is what creates equilibrium and all that's pure. This is what connects us to all that is pure. That's the great work. That's freedom. That's true responsibility. It's growth. It's spiritual alchemy, going from dark to light. Order out of chaos is about enlightenment out of ignorance. It's about enlightenment out of suffering or external government. It is internal government, which is internal monarchy, which is a positive expression of natural law. To not be ruled by rulers. So it's dealing with the here. This eschatology is dealing with the here and the now, and the hope for what's to come. It's the myth of the eternal return, which is the idea put forward of a cyclical view of history. That's one thing that helps the individual see the importance of spirituality in the first place, especially the patterns of downfalls of societies over and over again. So history is vital to our preparedness. It's vital to our understanding of mythical science. They complement each other. Historical eschatology gives meaning to mythical eschatology and vice versa. So historical eschatology teaches us what to prepare for and expect in the future by teaching us the past. It interprets the human condition defined in temporal terms and stories. And mythical eschatology teaches us the hope for a new beginning after the end, spiritually, of course. And it interprets the human condition in relation to the realm of the sacred and the profane as defined in non-temporal terms and stories. So what does temporal and non-temporal actually mean? So at the bottom, you see temporal is more of the literal worldly ideas, which is secular. It's non-spiritual. It's dealing with the sequence of time. So historical is temporal. And non-temporal doesn't deal with time. It's timeless. It's more about the infinite spirit. It's without locality of time. It's non-secular. And this is what I'm teaching with Osiris in the five epigominal days, the 5 days out of time. It's non-temporal. Spirit is non-temporal. Okay? So this is what helps us further understand the material and spiritual world. And it really helps us understand how much people live in the material world in the present day, as well as throughout the past, all through history. Even the so-called spiritualists, this is what I was talking about earlier. Many of the major religions of today, the so-called spiritualists, they're actually materialists. They're stuck literalizing religious eschatology as somehow being historical. This is where we're making some of the biggest mistakes, okay? We really have to take this serious and understand that historicizing is literalizing, and we have to be able to differentiate the mythical versus the historical and the religious, okay? So it's a lot, I understand. But we have to be honest. We have to take the time. We have to give the necessary attention, and we have to pattern recognize and understand the difference between black and white, or light and dark, or right and wrong. Okay, we have to understand the difference. So let's go to the next slide that says, quote unquote, historical. So there are three forms of historical eschatology that we really should acknowledge, just so we have a fuller understanding of this concept. Okay, so we have messianism, we have millennialism, and we have apocalypticism. Okay, all three are found in the major religions, including the three major religions, including Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And I'm going to get into that. So, messianism is derived from the Hebrew word Mashiach, meaning Anointed One, which deals with the hope directed at a single Messiah-like redemptive figure who will lead believers of God who are suffering and oppressed towards a better historical future or outcome. So messianism, or the messianic age, refers to the kingdom of God or the end of days, which is the idea or belief that there's going to be the coming of a Messiah or a resurrection of the righteous. And then there's going to be an afterlife, and there's a world beyond that is yet to come, aka the end days. And this is more of what the Abrahamic religions believe. Okay. So then we have millennialism, and millennialism is derived from the Latin 1,000 years. And this is what delves into the earthly prospects of human society rather than solely focusing on the individual's eternal destiny. It emphasizes collective salvation and posits that humanity will navigate through cataclysms during the impending end times, ultimately realizing the ancient aspiration of inhabiting an earthly paradise. And, you know, from what I understand, this concept is built around a passage in the Bible, the revelation to John, which is the 1,000 years. This is what describes a vision of Satan, which is Satan in the Bible is the adversary, the opposer, who is chained and thrown into the abyss, into the bottomless pit. Think about the zodiac. And he's thrown into this bottomless pit by an angel from the heavens. Okay, so really think about that. Plus, there is the raising of Christian martyrs from the dead in order to basically reign in heaven with Christ for, you know, a millennium, 1,000 years, right? So very, very interesting in correspondence to the zodiac. All right, so really think about that. And I'm going to go further into these three major religions. Okay, I'm getting us prepared for understanding these different ideas of eschatology in the quote-unquote historical way of understanding this science. Okay, so you have apocalypticism, and apocalypticism or apocalypse comes from the Greek apokalypsis, which means revelation. And, you know, this just means the uncovering, which really means uncovering the truth or the truth unveiled. So this is the historical context it deals with, which is the premise of a sudden cataclysmic intervention by God on the faithful minority. And according to this view, this world as we know it, unable to bear the justice of God, will be destroyed and replaced by a new world founded on God's righteousness. So it will be a new beginning for the faithful minority. Okay, so really just keep that in mind. And this is one major reason people have such a skewed understanding of the apocalypse. Okay, because they think about it in a religious sense. So it's mostly used in a literal sense by so many people, especially so many religious people that are not seeing that it's more of a spiritual apocalypse, which is all about seeing the dogma and becoming conscious of what is actually true by going into the dark. Because that is the apocalypse, going into the dark to unveil the dark, to unveil the information that is on the other side, the side that most people are too afraid, too cowardly to go into. You know, the age of information has been the biggest apocalypse, okay? We live in the apocalypse right now because of technology. Technology, the internet, is what has been such an unveiling. We are able to transfer information faster than any time in history that I know of, okay? And it's been a huge apocalypse for the past 30 or 40 years, but most people are just like, yeah, I'm just going to stick to being entertained and plugging my head into the sand and, you know, having my ears filled with entertainment and my eyes plugged, filled with entertainment, and my mouth completely zipped, you know, keep to myself, you know. Not going to look into anything that actually has value. And it's a very strange part of the ego or the R complex that keeps people in this mindset. So, you know, those who are dominating the R complex from the trenches of the dark, they're doing a really good job at keeping people very occupied in their darkness, or their ignorance. But really, it comes down to the individual who is choosing. Really, they're choosing to stay in ignorance because people know that people, they're not just trapped in materialism. They are peeking their head into the dark. They just choose to stay in the material light because it's comfy, it's warm. You can see what's going on, but can you really? You know, you don't really see what's going on. You can only see with your five senses when you're in the realm of the material light, okay, without spirit. And, okay, so just to make mention of a few of the ideas and tenets behind the three major religions, religious historical eschatologies, just so we can further understand this concept of eschatology in these belief systems. So if you go to the next slide, tenets of major religious eschatologies, you'll see Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. Okay, all three of these religions are Abrahamic religions, okay? These three religions are extremely important to understand, okay? You know, at least from having a basic understanding. I'm not saying go and study all three of these religions inside out. I'm not stopping anybody from doing that. I would never try to do so because these three religions are dominating most of the world in the mind, okay? And so that being said, it's really important to also understand their location geographically, okay? Because, you know, this is something that I get into with the earth brain. You know, to understand where these religions are centralized can really help us understand our own brain. In our own mind, okay? So Judaism is centralized in Jerusalem, in the land of Israel. Christianity is centralized in Rome, Italy, and Islam is largely centralized in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, okay? And of course, these religions are spread out all over the world. I'm not saying they're only in those pockets of these cities. I'm saying, you know, we have to understand where they are largely centralized, okay? And so these religions have a huge, heavy, heavy influence and effect on most of the minds of this world, and have for a very long, long time, okay? And so while I go through these eschatology tenets, I want the listener to really try to pattern recognize, like I've been saying, of what the, you know, the similarities are of these tenets, okay? And also, you know, I don't consider myself to be a scholar on the information of these religions, but I do gather the data that I find to have the value that I need in order to bring attention to the overarching subject, especially with eschatology. And I study this information very deeply, the parts that I am collecting very deeply, to see what is really being said or taught or described on a deeper level in the mysteries, especially. So studying these religions in particular is what I do. It's an ongoing study, because that's how important it is to understand where things went awry, to get to the bottom of why there are so many religions and what they represent in certain areas of the world. Okay? Pay attention to the symbolism. Pay attention to their logo. Pay attention to, are they more masculine or are they more feminine? Pay attention to these things. That is the pattern recognition. And when you do that, you will start to see why these religions are in the places that they're in the world, and why they have the certain teachings that they have, and where they come from. Okay, so the more that we go back in history and follow the ideas, follow the symbolism, follow the eschatology, follow the mythology, and you will start to see where these religions come from, where the ideas of these, or the teachings of these religions comes from, where they originate from, where they evolve from, you see. And, you know, I'm not going to just talk about these three particular major religions, but I'm going to also talk about the three major religious Eastern religions. Okay, those are also very important. So I'm just going to quickly go through these tenets of these religions, you know, being Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, and then I'll get into the Eastern religions. But again, I just want you to really pay attention, pattern recognize what's being taught in these religions, okay? So the first religion, before we go to the next slide, let's just go through these tenets, okay? So they're not just limited to three tenets, okay? I put these three tenets under each one of these religions just so we have an idea, because some of these religions have more tenets than others, okay? So Judaism has the Messiah and Messianic Age. That's something we talked about earlier. The resurrection of the dead, day of the Lord and final judgment. And then Islam has day of judgment, which is called Yom al-Din. And then you have the return of Jesus. You have resurrection of the dead. And then you have Christianity, which is the second coming of Jesus Christ. You have the resurrection of the dead. And you have establishment of God's kingdom. Okay? So we're going to start with Judaism. So the first, let's go to the next slide with the tenets of Jewish eschatology. Okay? So we have the Messiah and Messianic age. Okay? So at the core of Jewish eschatology lies the notion of the Messiah and the advent of a Messianic age. And this figure is anticipated to usher in an era marked by universal harmony, the reunification of Jewish diaspora communities, and the reconstruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Though interpretations of the Messiah may vary, the anticipation of a future Redeemer remains pivotal in shaping Jewish eschatological beliefs and expectations. So now we're on the second tenet, which is resurrection of the dead. So the resurrection of the dead is a fundamental tenet in Jewish eschatology, symbolizing the divine justice of God. While not as extensively elaborated on or upon as in certain Christian traditions, Jewish eschatology maintains the belief that upon the culmination of time, the deceased will be resurrected and held to account for their actions. This concept underscores the enduring principle that divine justice transcends individual lifetimes. Okay, let's go to the third part. The day of the Lord and final judgment. So we have Jewish eschatology includes the anticipation of the day of the Lord, a pivotal moment when God will directly intervene in human affairs. This day is imbued with the significance of divine judgment, rewarding the righteous and penalizing the wicked. While specific details may differ among various Jewish traditions, the expectation of a future reckoning remains a prevalent theme in Jewish eschatology. Okay, so I hope you're paying attention to the tenets, okay? Because you'll see how they align. There's a syncretism between these tenets, okay? So let's go to the next slide with the tenets of Islamic eschatology, which is Islamic eschatology is rooted in the teachings of the Quran, okay? These are the sayings and the actions of the prophet who is Muhammad, which encompasses a few of the main tenets. Okay, so these are three. Okay, so there are multiple tenets. Okay, there's so much to all of these religions. And again, I'm just trying to narrow it down to really help us see the connections, okay? The similar ideas, the similar sciences, the similar beliefs, okay? So the first day of Judgment, which is Yom al-Din. At the heart of Islamic eschatology lies the concept of the Day of Judgment, or Yom al-Din. According to Muslim belief, Allah, the God, will resurrect every individual who has ever lived at the appointed time, and they will be judged according to their actions. Those who lived righteously will be granted eternal paradise, while the unrighteous will endure punishment in hell. So think about that in the sense of, you know, we're always demonizing hell. We're always saying this is the place that no one wants to go to. But think about that, you know, flipped. No one wants to go to hell because no one wants to do the work. No one wants to go through the suffering of doing the great work. But this fundamental belief underscores the importance of individual accountability and affairs, and affirms the ultimate justice of Allah. And, you know, again, I just want to say something else about the punishment in hell, because just think about this. All these religions, they always make you fear hell. Okay, so just keep that in mind, because that's what keeps people in the belief and faith system. Because people believe that they are going to go to heaven if they have faith or have belief, not understanding that they really are in hell, because they're afraid of hell, but they're in hell. So, you know, it's about keeping people in confusion of reality, so that way they will stay in their religion. Okay. Now let's go to the second part, the second tenet, which is the return of Jesus. So Islamic eschatology includes the belief in the return of Jesus, who is considered a prophet, not a messiah, in Islam. Muslims anticipate that Jesus will return in the future as part of the eschatological events. His return is associated with defeating the false messiah, Dajjal, and establishing justice and righteousness on earth. While the details may vary, the return of Jesus is a shared eschatological expectation among Muslims. Now, the third tenet is the resurrection of the dead. A trumpet will blast, signaling the destruction of earth. A second blast will signal the death of any being still living. The dead will then be resurrected and afterlife commence with yet another trumpet blast. The first to arise will be Muhammad, followed by the other members of the Muslim community, with all gathering at the place of assembly. In between resurrection and the actual judgment will be an agonizing time of waiting for unbelievers. Okay, so, you know, there's a few things I'd like to talk about with Islam that are concerning this eschatology, but it's something a little bit more dealing with the phonetics and also some symbolism. Okay, so I'm just going to take this moment to talk about this for a little bit, because I find it to be very interesting in correspondence with these tenets, but also going back to ancient Egypt, because in Islam, there's this word, this name, Ma'ad. So M-A-apostrophe-A-D, which means resurrection. And Ma'ad is derived from the root word Aud, A-U-D, which means to return, hence the returning of the spirit, which they call the Ruh. Think about that. It's spelled R-O-O-H, okay, being the spirit, the Ruh, back to its body, which is called Ma'ad. So Ma'ad is one of the fundamental principles of Islamic faith and belief. Because Ma'ad, now think about this, also, Ma'ad translates to eschatology. Okay? And I just want to note that I'm sure anybody listening, when I talked about the what's phonetically in relation to Ma'ad, I'm sure your mind, if you've been listening to these shows, your mind went directly to Ma'at, and you are correct. Because what does Ma'at represent? In the eschatology, she represents goodness, she represents correctness, she represents straightness and truth and justice. And this deals with, again, this is dealing with the eschatology, because Ma'at is dealing with the scales. She's waiting for the dead to be able to pass into the afterlife, to weigh their heart against the feather. And there's no coincidence that Ma'ad and Ma'at sound alike and have a similar meaning to them. And again, we have to understand that these modern religions are fragments of the old mythology and the old eschatology. And of course, these religions, the people from these religions, they'll tell you that their religion is the only religion, the only true religion, and that they are developed, and they don't, you know, negate the other past religions and all this, but they say that they are the only true religion, and their religion comes from God or Allah. Okay, so you know, this is what I want to tell all religious people. In order to understand your creator or the creator, you have to be honest in your journey of trying to learn and understand. Just having faith, just having belief is, again, it's not going to get you to the truth. It's not going to get you closer to the creator. And here's another thing about Muslims that I find very fascinating. So think about the zodiac. And I'm just going to keep using the zodiac as a frame of reference, because it's just so fruitful. It's so packed with information. But think about the side of a brain, okay? If you can imagine the side of a brain, go pull it up on Google. Look at the side of a human brain, and then I want you to relate that to a Muslim bowing down, going on their knees and hands, and putting their head, resting their head on the ground. They're putting this is their prayer position. Okay, so when they do this, they're having a moment or a time period throughout the day. They do this multiple times a day to pray to Allah. to give their time to Allah, to God, okay? And so when they do this, they're putting their head down on the ground, okay? And this looks just like, I mean, if you compare it symbolically to the brain, it looks the same. It has that thrice position, which is, you know, the body is folded up in a thrice position with the head down on the ground. Because we have to remember, Mecca means mother city. Islam means submission to God or the creator. And therefore, when a Muslim is doing their prayer, they're putting their head towards the ground. Well, think about the zodiac, okay? Think about the autumn equinox line and the spring equinox line, but just think about the autumn equinox line. Think about that being the ground and then the soil is below, right? The soil is below, okay? So that, if you can imagine someone, a Muslim, going down, putting their head to the ground, they're putting their head to the sacred feminine, the mother, right? So it's very beautiful what they're actually doing in nature, whether they are conscious of that or not. But the point is that they really are symbolically going down to the ground to give their time, give their energy to the Great Mother, to the soil. And it's very interesting because when you think of it as the brain, it's like their head would be right where the R complex is, because that's the bottom. So it's, you know, giving that time to the other side, the place of darkness, which is the place of the mother, the place of the sacred feminine, the place of soil, the earth, Mother Earth, right? Anyway, I find beauty in all religions. I think there's so much beauty in all of them, but I can see the corruption. I can see the corruption in all these religions, especially because they historicize. They're very literal. They believe. They have faith. They don't have a real gnosis. They don't have a real understanding of what their religion really is as a mind control mechanism that is using them through their faith and through their belief. Because the only way to truth is through knowledge, not through faith, not through belief. So I just want to really stress that. So let's go to the next slide, which is the tenets of Christianity, of eschatology, of their eschatology. So the second coming of Jesus Christ is the eschatology. This eschatology revolves around the anticipation of the second coming of Jesus Christ. Christians believe in his eventual return to earth, literally, fulfilling as a prophecy. So this event is intricately linked with the final judgment, where individuals will be held accountable for their actions. The righteous are expected to be rewarded, while the unrighteous will face consequences. So the second tenet is the resurrection of the dead. A fundamental belief is the resurrection of the dead. This doctrine holds that during the end times, the deceased will be brought back to life, and the believers will receive glorified, immortal bodies. This concept is firmly grounded in Christian scripture, appearing in both the Old and New Testaments, and is considered a pivotal element in the ultimate redemption. Okay, so there's a lot there. Okay, so the next tenet is establishing of God's kingdom. Christian eschatology anticipates the realization of God's kingdom in its entirety. This vision often includes the concept of a new heaven and a new earth, where God's perfect order reigns supreme. The climax of history is perceived as a period when God's sovereignty is universally recognized and a state of peace and justice prevails. Various Christian denominations may offer differing interpretations regarding the specifics of this kingdom's nature and the timeline of its establishment. Okay, so I really want people, I hope that you're seeing the interesting syncretism between all of these three major religions. Okay, especially, you know, it's obvious that you see the resurrection of the dead motif over and over and over. Okay, this is huge in understanding, because this is where they are literalizing some type of Messiah, some type of redemptive figure. Okay, and if people could just understand, this is about each one of us and our internal journey. That's why there are esoteric traditions or systems that help deal with these traditions, these literalized traditions. Okay. It's very, very powerful knowledge. And I mean, all these different esoteric systems can really help us further navigate these motifs, these stories, these eschatologies. Now, essentially, many of these religions, what they've really done well with is being good recruiters, the recruiters of these religions, and getting their recruits to buy into the idea of some kind of reward in the afterlife after their, you know, lifelong sacrifice to maintain their belief, to maintain their faith in one of these religions or cults that they've been recruited into. So this is a type of retention. Okay, so a retention is a holdout that the recruits maintain as a belief for what's to come in the future after death, for fear of some kind of punishment after death. Or if they've been good, if they have done everything that they've been told to believe, you know, there'll be some kind of reward if they succeed. And, you know, spiritually, aka allegorically, the reward, if you really think about it, is more truth, which means more growth and more awareness or consciousness. Okay, and there's a lot more to that, but materialistically, there is fear-based mind control on a mass scale that's been taking place for thousands of years because of these religions, because of the faith, which is very much rooted in social Darwinism and violence. It's not truly based in spiritual growth. It's not based in natural law. There's much more to this, but I'm just trying to make sure to give some examples, okay? So we're going to go to the next slide, and then we're going to get into the Eastern traditions, okay? And I think this next slide, the Alpha and the Omega, this is a big, big deal, okay? And this is supposedly a Christian doctrine in the book of Revelation, which defines the Creator as what remains from the beginning to the end of time. And the Greek Alpha and Omega symbols that you see in the book, these are the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. So it's a book of the beginning and the end, which symbolically means becoming conscious of the Creator, the creation, and nature through knowledge. And that doesn't mean, you know, limited to the Bible, okay? It just means the book of nature, truly. When you really know how to read it, when you really know what it's really saying, okay? Spiritually, of course. So symbolically, the book, in this case, being the Bible. The Bible, think about this, the Bible is made of 66 books. That means 39 books that make up the Old Testament, and then 27 books that make up the New Testament. Think about that. Now, it's pretty obvious that 66 equates to what? What is 6 plus 6? It's 12, right? Well, what's that correspond to? 12 months, 12 houses of the zodiac, 12 apostles. But the point is, 66 is also 6 houses in the upper and 6 houses in the lower half of the zodiac. Okay? Think about that, because it's a divider, 6 and 6. It's a divider. Because you have the 6 of the upper, the 6 on, in the lower, you have 12. Okay? But there's a half. There's a halfway mark. You can look at that as the equator or the spring and fall equinox line that goes all the way across. Okay? So the point is that, you know, this book is analogous to Osiris as the one. And the books are analogous to dismembered pieces being 12. That's the way the thinking has to be done. Okay? So we have to understand that the Christian doctrine is a solar cult overlap. It's a degradation that maintained the idea of Osiris as the X, because remember I said Christ is X, which is Osiris, okay? Because X means Christ, which is Osiris, okay? It's an overlap of Osiris, but it's with a, you know, a whole new veneered doctrine that has very blatantly become material based, okay? Something that I've explained and I'm going to continue to explain. You know, also think about this. You know, looking at that symbol, the Omega symbol on the book, what does that look like? It looks like a horseshoe. So think about that phonetically. A horseshoe. Horus. Shoe. Well, anyway, we'll get more into that as we move forward, okay? But that's very, very important to pay attention to. So, you know, here's another thing too is, you know, we have to understand that time is understood as both irreversible and linear in Western religions. And because of this, the end is thought to occur as, you know, this big event once and for all. And it's really no different when you think of atheists who mostly believe that life is material only. And it's all just, you know, it's all just a one and done deal. Okay, that's it. You know, when you die, that's it. You decay in the dirt, and that's all there is. That's, you know, I talked about this before, but that is their eschatology. That's their limitation of eschatology. Think about that. Think about how limited that is. And that's why atheists fit in the historical eschatology box. And, you know, Christians and Muslims, think about this. They tend, when you really look at their belief system, they set their minds to an afterlife. Okay? Forgetting that now is all that there is. And accordingly, it is believed the final judgment will be followed by the creation of a new and sacred world that is eternal. But that's really just about the internal spiritual aspect of the here and now. So again, atheists fit in the same box, really, with Christians and Muslims and others because of, you know, when it comes to atheists, they live this life of this belief system that since you're here, just have fun. Don't look into anything. Just, you know, and it's so funny because, you know, I've always associated with atheism with science because we have to just remember that most atheists are very lazy in their science because they're really just looking into anything that can debunk any type of religion, which, you know, there's good in that, but they throw the whole baby out with the bathwater when they do that. And it's very unscientific at that moment, you see, because they don't go any further. They don't go into the actual eschatology. That is why, again, atheists' eschatology is dirt. That's it. That is their eschatology. So, you know, and again, it's just basically say this whole life is all there is. This one human life of however many years, that's all that there is. Okay. No spirituality involved in that. I mean, truly, spirituality is about going through atheism at some point because we're all spiritual beings, truly. It's just we have forgotten that we are spiritual beings because spiritual beings, to become conscious of being spiritual, is about being honest and actually going through the dark to find your care, to find the light. Atheists that get stuck in these belief ruts where all they do is just mock Christians and Muslims and Jews, that's all they do. And they forget because they're just having too much fun. Everything is fun. Everything is hedonistic about their worldview. Just have fun and, you know, don't look into anything any further. Just believe that there is no such thing as God or there is no creator or because it's a belief system. They don't actually know. They don't have a gnosis yet. Okay, they're stagnant. So But, you know, when you look at Christians and Muslims in the sense that they believe everything is determined, and it's not just Christians and Muslims, it's other religions too, but Christians and Muslims especially believe that everything's determined. All you got to do is have faith and belief, and you will, you know, if you believe in Jesus and God, you'll go to the afterlife, and that's all you need to set your mind to. And I hear this all the time, and it's sad because they really have just given up their real spiritual journey. They have not questioned reality. They have not questioned the Creator. Questioning the Creator is getting to know the Creator. If you go to, you know, if you want to know something or know someone, what do? You question it. You question them. Well, it's the same thing with the Creator. Question the Creator. Question the Creator's creation. I just wish people would just listen to themselves and question their beliefs. That's all it takes. Question things. Question yourself. Question the Creator. Question others who write these texts. You know, really see how things go together. See what is ontological and objective. See what is subjective and doesn't, you know, completely add up, but is important. You know, we have to, you know, be more honest. So try really hard to not follow or fall into a religion, because falling into religion means to stop growth. It means to stop consciousness from expanding. It doesn't mean you're not going to have an experience or even a great experience, because you probably will have a lot of great experiences being part of a religion. But it just means that you're going to not only stunt your growth, but also you're going to, you know, when people become religious, they don't realize that they're actually expanding ignorance, which expands slavery. See, so there's a lot to it, but that's why, you know, we really have to wake up out of this mire of darkness, of ignorance. So now we're going to go to the three major Eastern religious eschatologies, okay? So I really do believe it's important to mention these three religions, these three Eastern Asian traditions and their eschatologies, because we have to measure them with the other religions to really see what is synchronizing or what is the syncretism between them. Okay, what is similar between them, so we can get back to the truth, so we can hone in on what's so true about them. This is all about understanding esotericism. This is about being an eclectic researcher. Okay, this is what Freemasonry is all about. True Freemasonry is about being eclectic in your research. And so these are non-historical Eastern religious eschatologies, and the aspects of these eschatologies are not limited. Again, they're not limited to just three, okay? So there's so much to each one of these religions, but I'm making sure to cover a few very important characteristics or tenets of these major traditions, these Eastern religious eschatologies, okay? So I'm just going to go run down these real quick, and then we're going to jump into the deeper definitions, okay? So you have Hinduism, and these are not in order, okay? In the sense of like what came first or who has more value or anything like that. I'm just laying these out so we can see the similarities, okay? So Hinduism is dealing with what's known as the three, the Shristi and the Sthisti and the Pralaya. And then second is Samsara, and then third is Moksha. And with Buddhism, you have impermanence and change, which is called Anicca. And then second is cyclical time, which is Kalpas. And then you have third, which is end of Samsara. And then Taoism is the third, or the first is cyclical nature of existence. Second is immortality and transcendence. And third is return to source. Okay, so let's go to the next slide, which is Hinduism. Okay, so this is dealing with mythical or relative. Okay, what is relative? So Hinduism is dealing with Srishti, Sthiti, and Pralaya. And those first two words are very difficult for me to pronounce correctly, so forgive me if I did not pronounce them correct. But this is dealing with the cycle of creation. Okay, so this illustrates the perpetual rhythm of creation, preservation, and dissolution within the cosmos. This cyclical worldview reflects the Hindu understanding of time as eternal and infinite, with the universe undergoing an endless series of births, existences, and endings. Okay? Samsara, the second tenet, is karma and reincarnation. Okay? So according to these beliefs, individuals accumulate karma, the effects of their actions, which determine their future experiences and circumstances, that's natural law, but including their rebirth in subsequent lifetimes. Okay, and yes, I would apply natural law to that too. So the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth continues until one achieves liberation, which is moksha, from samsara. Okay, so again, the third tenet, moksha, being liberation. The ultimate goal of Hindu eschatology is liberation. It's moksha from the cycle of birth and death, which is samsara. So moksha is attained through spiritual realization and union with the divine, which is Brahman, the creator principle. It represents freedom from suffering and the realization of one's true nature as eternal and unchanging. And that's what immortality is. Okay? So we can clearly see this is not based in a historical framework. It's got an organic tone to it, if you want to look at it like that. It's more in line with nature. Okay? So then we're going to go to the next slide, which is Buddhism. So Buddhism, Buddha means the awakened. Okay? So, and that's very important because that's what this is trying to help people do, have their awakening, okay? But it's, again, these are still religions, and I'm not going to get into why they are quite religions, but of course, anybody who's really paying attention can understand why they are, in fact, religions. But you can learn a lot from these religions, especially, I mean, any of these religions, you can learn so much, but, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, I would say are more in line with nature. But again, there's a lot of issues with these traditions. But the first tenet of Buddhism is impermanence and change, which is called Anicca. Okay, so central to Buddhist thought is the concept of impermanence, which is, again, anicca, which asserts that all conditioned phenomena are subject to change and eventually decay. That's the impermanence. That's anicca. So this includes the universe itself, which undergoes cycles of creation and destruction. The impermanent nature of existence is emphasized in Buddhist teachings, highlighting the need to cultivate detachment and non-attachment to worldly phenomena. Again, very non-material and non-historical. So the third or the second tenet is kulpas, which is dealing with cyclical time. So similar to Hinduism, many Buddhist traditions describe time as cyclical, with the universe undergoing repeated cycles of creation and existence and dissolution. These cycles are known as kulpas, and they are said to be immense periods of time encompassing the birth and destruction of worlds. So this is the idea that everything is together as one. You know, it's everything is connected as one big organism, okay? So the third tenet is the end of samsara, okay? This is connected with Hinduism. So in Theravada Buddhism, there is a focus on individual liberation from the cycle of rebirth, which is samsara, through the attainment of nirvana, nirvana is the highest state of being, okay, which is in this cessation of suffering and the end of the cycle of birth and death. While there may not be specific end time prophecy in Theravada Buddhism, the ultimate goal remains the liberation from suffering for all beings. So overall, Buddhism's eschatological beliefs emphasize the impermanent nature of existence, the cyclical nature of time, and the potential for liberation from suffering through spiritual practice and realization. And many of the interpretations vary among the different Buddhist traditions, but the overarching aim is the alleviation of suffering and the attainment of enlightenment for the self and all sentient beings. So, you know, very in alignment with natural law. And this is the overarching idea of the second degree of esoteric Freemasonry. Okay. Dealing with these different tenets, they're very similar, or sciences in nature. Okay. So now we're going to go to the next slide, which is Taoism. So think about this. The Tao means the way. That's what Tao means, the way. Okay, that's the most simple way to define the Tao, okay? And it's interesting. I just want to make this correspondence because I talked about this and I didn't mention it on the show where I think it was a couple shows ago where I explained that the zodiac is the yin-yang symbol. So you have the white dot of material going down into the... So you have the little yang dot of material going down into the black, the yin energy. And then when that material goes down into the yin energy, then rises the black dot, the black yin energy, the spirit that rises into the material. You see? So that's what that represents. That's why that symbol is correct in the way that it looks. that you see on this slide. Okay. But the other correspondence is that the zodiac actually translates to the way. So that's what it is. It's Tao. It is the Tao. It is the yin yang. Okay. It's just, this is syncretism. It's saying the same thing, but in a different way. You see, in a different language, in a different symbol. Okay. So very beautiful correspondence. So this Tao is the cyclical nature of existence. Okay. That is the first tenet. So Taoism views existence as cyclical, with phenomena continually arising and dissipating in accordance with the interplay of yin and yang energies. This cyclical perspective extends to the cosmos as a whole, with the universe undergoing cycles of creation, transformation, and renewal. These cycles are not seen as linear progression towards a final endpoint, but rather as perpetual fluctuations within the cosmic order. So the second tenet is the immortality and transcendence. So Taoist practices often focus on the attainment of immortality or transcendence through inner cultivation and alchemical practices. Immortality in Taoism is not necessarily understood in a literal sense, but rather as a state of spiritual awakening and liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Through practices such as meditation, breathwork, and inner alchemy, practitioners seek to refine and purify their vital energy, which is the qi, in order to attain greater levels of spiritual realization. Okay, so, you know, this qi energy, it literally means air, water, vapor, or breath, and really all energy in nature or the universe. Okay, so this is something that we can tap into. And the second tenet is return to source. So Taoist teachings emphasize the return to the primordial state where individual identity dissolves into the unmanifest Tao. This return is not seen as annihilation, but rather as a reunion with the source of all existence, where distinctions between self and other, subject and object, dissolve. It is akin to a merging or blending back into the cosmic whole. So consciously becoming one with the all. And, you know, Taoist eschatology, what it does is it emphasizes the cultivation of inner harmony, alignment with the natural order, and the pursuit of, this is all about spiritual realization rather than focusing on specific end time events or some type of eschatological narratives. Taoism encourages individuals to, you know, live in harmony with the Tao and to realize their inherent connection to the cosmos, to the universe, to nature. So think about this. Think about the literacy of the Western traditions who focus on the historicization of events in correspondence to the left brain, which is associated with the sacred masculine, which is associated with materialism. And then think about these Eastern traditions who take more of a mythical approach, who don't literalize historical events in their eschatology. And because it's Eastern, it's associated with the sacred feminine, the right brain, which is associated with what? Spirit. Okay? It's associated with nature. But, you know, obviously it's passive. Okay? These Eastern traditions are mostly passive traditions. Okay? So we have to recognize that. But the point is, if you've watched or studied my Earth Brain 1 and 2, you will see what I'm really getting at here with these traditions being associated with the right part of the world, the Eastern traditions, and then the more Western traditions are associated with the left brain. Okay, so you have materialism and spirit, and they're largely separate from each other. Okay, this is all about understanding that we have naturally separated, but we've also been balkanized, and we have been segregated with this, you know, these different religions and these different ideas. But as we understand enough of each one of them, we can really start to build a big picture to see what's really going on here. And that's why I believe the Earth Brain model is so important as a correspondence to the self, as a correspondence to religion and these different sciences and different rituals. And obviously it goes much further than that with understanding the South Hemisphere is also the sacred feminine, and the North Hemisphere is the sacred masculine. So that it's very complex, but it's, you have to orient yourself to really see it and appreciate it, you know? So there's a lot to this. And I think we're around the 3-hour mark, and the next part of this is probably a little too big to open up at this point. So I think what I'm going to do is just end it here. And I really hope that what I have brought to the table has really helped people see the syncretism of this eschatology. Okay, so again, I'm going to bring this over into the next episode, and we're really going to open it up even further, because we got to get back to the ancient Egyptian eschatology, dealing with the solar, the lunar, and the stellar, and really start to see where these ideas really originate from. So that way we have a better understanding of why things have become so corrupt in these modern religions, okay, how they've become fragmented from something so pure and so whole. Okay, so that being said, I really hope that you guys have found value in this information. I really appreciate you tuning in. And if you're interested for more shows, presentations, or news, please go to cubbyhole.com. And also, if you have any questions regarding any of the topics of any of these shows, please email me at cubbyhole@mail.com. I'll do my best to get back to you. And please email me if you'd like to be on the list, the Cubbyhole News, regarding new presentations, major events, or any of the newest podcast episodes. Okay? So, also, one more thing. Thank you to all who have donated to the Cubbyhole. I really appreciate it, because it really does, you know, add in to helping with the upkeep of this whole website, especially. That's where all that money goes to, or the donations, that's where it goes to. And I really, really appreciate it. And also, I made some other forms of donation available, being Bitcoin and Ethereum as a form of cryptocurrency donation. So you can go to the donation page and you'll see where you can now donate through those different currency receivers. Okay. So on that note, I'm your host, Nate Kapp. Thank you for listening and giving your time and attention. And keep in mind to do no harm, defend truth, and keep transcending dogma.